This content is issued by Zeus Capital Limited, which is authorised and regulated in the United Kingdom by the Financial Conduct Authority for designated investment business and is a member firm of the London Stock Exchange. Nothing in this podcast should be viewed as investment advice. Listeners should consult an investment professional before making any decisions regarding topics mentioned in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not of Zeus. Please note that participants in this podcast may have financial interests in the matters discussed. Hi, I'm Nick Searle, a member of the Zeus Equity Sales team and host of A Different Perspective. Here we interview interesting characters from the world of business and finance and uncover a different perspective. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts or contact me at live@zeuscapital.co.uk. It's Thursday, 29th of February. With me today, I have Giles English. Giles and his brother Nick founded the UK's luxury mechanical watch brand Bremont in 2002. I'm lucky enough to be at their wonderful factory in Henley today. Giles, good morning.
Morning, Nick. Thank you for coming and visiting us.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. What a wonderful sight you have. I think it'd be great for the listeners to start with a bit of your background and what got you interested in flying and in obviously in watches.
Well, of course. Do you want me to start from the very beginning?
Wherever you want to start.
Southampton University, as you know. I studied naval architecture there. I always wanted to either go down the sort of the engineering route or I was sponsored by the RAF. So I was going to go into the RAF or engineering. And then last year of uni, my sort of life changed dramatically. And my father and brother were in a plane crash. And my father died, brother broke 30-odd bones. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you hit this tipping point and everything changes. Came out of that and, life wasn't going to be quite the same. I wasn't going to go into the RAF anymore. I found myself going into the city in corporate finance.
Happens to the best of us.
Well, it does. And especially, it's so sad in engineering is you come out, you're looking for a job, and you think, I'd love to go and work for this in one of these engineering companies, and they pay you nothing. Mm-hmm. But you have the city calling, willing to pay you a lot more. I succumbed to that and went to the city for a bit. And the company called Williams Dubrow had a fascinating time. I sort of learned everything about how to read a balance sheet, analyzing companies. We're doing sort of small AIM listings. So it's sort of, I think in life, if you can have some time in the city, it gets rid of your chip about the city.
I think that's very fair. Yes. Yeah.
So that I love, but I knew it was never going to be for me long term. And after Dad died, he had this little aviation business restoring historical aircraft, old Spitfires, and it had this sort of fixed base operator at a place called Northwild Airfield, just on the M11 outside London. And it was all going horribly wrong. And my brother had just qualified at PwC. Mm-hmm. He had recovered from his terrible injuries. And so we said, look, let's go and run this business. Let's go and sort it out. And had an amazing sort of year there together, sorting this business out. But we quickly realized that we'd be the best in the world at this. And it wasn't really going to be a lifetime business. So we put new management in, but figured out, we could work together.
Mm-hmm. Do you still own the?
We owned it for about 15 years and sold out of it. I'm a believer if you have these hassles in your background, this weight on your shoulders, either it's going to make a lot of money and you enjoy it or just get rid of it.
Yeah, it can be a distraction.
Total distraction. And it was becoming when you dread going to a board meeting, it's time to get out of it.
Yeah, that's fair. So you learned you could work with Nick.
So learned I work with Nick. And it's brilliant when you have someone you can work with who you ultimately trust. You like the same stuff. So decision making is very easy.
Yes.
And I think in business, trust is everything. And you've got to believe they've got the right soul. when the shit hits the fan, which inevitably it does, you're going to watch each other's backs. And yeah, so that was, that's, it's always worked together. So we had this aviation business, we got out of that, and it was dot-com time.
Yes, so what, 99?
Or it was, before? Yeah, 98, 99. Yeah. And we had this friend who came to us and said, look, I've been working for Microsoft. I've been working on how to put video on the internet. And this is the first day just seeing video on the internet in terrible quality and audio. And he said, well, I think we could put a little business together where we could specialize and offer this to anyone who wants to put video audio on the internet. And
you never know, it might catch on.
Might catch on. Early days. And at that time, Broadband was going to grow, you know, moved on from the 28 bits per second, and ISDN was coming in. There's going to be broadband, and so we set up this little business specializing in providing people the ability to put video live and archive on the internet. And we became quite good at it quite quickly, and we ended up buying a couple other businesses. We reversed into a company on AIM, listed that. I think I was the youngest director on the stock market at the time. But the challenge you had, broadband was going a lot slower than it was.
It still is now.
So it was happening a lot slower. And we had this website that we're trying to do early sort of YouTube type stuff. But you weren't having the backing of the big boys like you would do if you'd been in Silicon Valley. And so we became more niche. It was successful, but it was never going to be as big as the, you know, you're never going to go down the YouTube route. And we sold the business off to a company called Interroot, big telecom provider. They wanted broadband down their pipes, and we had some bit of tech. And Nick and I had some cash in our pockets, and we thought, well, what next? And this really goes back to the beginning of our story of my father. He was this sort of unbelievable man. He was a PhD aeronautical engineer from Cambridge, brain the size of a building, and had all these amazing interests and built his own planes, which we still fly today. Built a sailing boat we went and lived on as kids, but also loved his watches and clocks. And so we had this family workshop. We used to go and fix these old clocks. We had all these lathes. And so it was always a big family passion of ours. And when Dad died, your life changes, but you don't lose these passions. They almost become more powerful because it takes you back to that connection with your father. And so we'd always loved this, and we're so aware of this history of British watchmaking. And you know, few people realize that Rolex was founded in London. The world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time. One point we're making half the world's watches and clocks in this country. And there were no British watch companies out there. And what I'd learned from our broadcasting days and our aviation days is actually, if you're in a massive market, it makes a lot better than a tiny one. And we saw the size of the luxury watch market. We saw its growth. And we thought, actually, why is there not a British watch company? This is truly a passion project, but actually we think we can do something with it. So we went over to Switzerland, and we said to our wives, yeah, a couple of years, we'll get it sussed. We'll learn how to build a watch, and we'll bring that skill set back to the UK.
Were the Swiss quite open?
No, absolutely not. So that's why, after 2 years, we hadn't built a watch. But, you know, pretending to our wives is all going incredibly well, using up all our money that we had. And it took us 5 years to launch our first watch, and then a further 3 years before we could bring any of that manufacturing back to the UK. And but it was an amazing journey. But your challenge with watchmaking is you are this very high-tech engineering company. We're making stuff to 3 or 4 microns. Human hair is 60, 70 microns. Yes. So hundreds and hundreds of components within a watch. And you're also a marketing agency. People won't buy your brand until they've seen about you, the things you've sponsored, etc. You're a retailer. We now own probably 15 of our own stores. You're a wholesaler. So it's everything about watchmaking is complicated, hence the barriers to entry are so damn huge. We start on a day before social media. I think we were one of the first sort of watch companies to launch a Facebook account. And so you and days before Kickstarters, all these small brands you see now. So we really were one of the few new entrants into the market. And it's been an amazing journey since then. I mean, lots of highs and lows, and still are. But I think in any business, if you're genuinely passionate about the product you're trying to produce, it makes it a lot more fun.
What do you think you've learned most about running the business?
I think
that can be about the business or about you.
I think with anything, well, first about myself, I've learned as an entrepreneur or being in any business is you cannot be good at everything. And your ego says you can be. Mm-hmm. And I think probably to be an entrepreneur, there is a little bit of narcissism within you. You need that confidence, otherwise.
Do you initially, did you and Nick split roles? Are you better at some and Nick better at others?
He has probably, it's developed into it. I was probably more of the marketing side and sales. He was probably more on product and delivery of that product as well, and design. But I think back to this point of knowing what you're good and bad at in life, I think it takes you many years before you can say, actually, I'm not very good at that. Mm-hmm. I will get someone better in to do that. So that was a big part of understanding that, I think, in life. I think the other side is in building something, it's very easy to give up too early.
Yes.
And I've said this before, we had this wonderful financial director who joined us, and Fiona, who's this wonderful lady, who came up one day and said, I know, I've sussed it. What in business and with you guys, what I've seen working with you is this 3x rule. Everything takes 3x longer. Mm-hmm. Everything costs 3x more. And everything is 3x harder work. And I do believe in businesses, people just aren't either willing to put those 3x in, or they give up at 2x and never reach that end of that journey to actually make it work.
So that perseverance is very much an attribute that will make it successful.
Oh yeah, totally. And but you'll only have that perseverance if you generally enjoy what you're doing. And so if you can get involved with a business you're genuinely passionate about, you know, that work throughout the night is not hard work. It's exciting. Yeah. It's fun.
Well, that's the great saying, isn't it? If you find a job you love, you never work a day in your life.
Yeah. And it's with your investments, I think it's very true. I think the other thing with investments and a business like Bremont, it's a constant evolving investment piece. If you want to build a global luxury brand, it's not going to be cheap. Mm-hmm. So you have to get investors in, and that's a challenge, getting the right investors into your business that will change the nature of what you're trying to do and the relationship, obviously, Nick and myself, it's with other people. And it is a constant journey, and it's ever evolving.
And then what do you think was the biggest hurdle? When on those dark days, what was the biggest hurdle, and then how did you overcome those? Is it just the perseverance?
I think there's two in my world. Building the product is incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. So to make a product that is great takes up so many hours of your day. And then the other time is you've got to tell people about that product. So, you know, I was on a plane constantly around the world showing people, chatting out retailers, press. So you can have the best product in the world. If no one knows about it,
it's,
people aren't going to buy it.
Exactly.
and our competition was always the big boys, and the big boys are owned by the big groups, mm-hmm. LVMH, Richemont, etc., or big independents like a Rolex, whose marketing budgets are so humongous that you can't even get near them on a spending level. So you have to be clever.
So I think that's what you've been, very clever. So your ambassador program is you know, highly regarded, and we're sitting in your wonderful Stephen Hawking room here. You've been very good at finding niches that yet appeal to a much broader audience.
Yeah, I think that is key, and I think you can't attack people head on. But I think also all the things we've got involved with, whether it was the America's Cup and personal interest and obviously sailing and naval architecture to the military, 20% of our business is just working for the military.
You know, and that's bespoke watches for certain squadrons and regiments.
Exactly. So we've made for over 500 different military units, anything from special forces to aviators all around the world. But Nick and I can talk the language. It's being in a world that you feel comfortable with, and you can genuinely back up your product, I think makes a big difference. But you had to box clever. And it's very easy in marketing, if you've got money, to waste it.
Of course, yes. Yeah. So it's by not having money, then I guess you're very, very careful where you spend it.
You're very careful. And I think, but times have changed. It's all social media. When we started, it really wasn't. And the cost of acquisition through social media now is just gone ridiculously high. Yes. So will it go back to old school marketing? Yeah. I think there's an element of that. I think it's a difficult world now where can you differentiate between real proper product and sort of flashy looking product that is nothing behind it.
I mean, I guess ethos. I get this feeling that the world has changed in post COVID, that there is a desire for ethos and history and heritage of a product that will last. And so I guess a good looking working product should sell.
Yeah, I think when you, as long as people know about that, mm-hmm. but I think there's also, and the great thing about social media, people can sort of pick behind the scenes and really understand what your product's about. I think it was very important for me as a businessman as well, and it is to have integrity over to what you're trying to do. And I think I've been slightly obsessed with this British made story, and that has been partly because I've just generally loved seeing manufacturing under my own roof, which is incredibly complicated to do, though. And I think we've probably made the company too complicated in many respects because we've done so much of that manufacturing. But I also see a country like Britain, it needs to manufacture and it needs to build up that skill base, and if you lose it, you never get it back. And it's so damn hard to create and bring in. And I also think it's control of quality as well.
Yes.
And we saw COVID with supply chains disappearing.
Yeah. Was COVID tough for you?
It was tough in the respect that you've got retailers around the world, you've got staff around the world you can't see. The watch market grew as volume because people were sitting at home and they had money to spare.
So those game shops, GameStop shares people were buying.
It's all those games. It's all that stuff. Yeah. But it was hard because we had stores that were shut. So I think if you're an online business, it was fantastic because you just grew. If you had physical businesses, it was challenging. And obviously supply chain was challenging. What happened in the Swiss industry is that everyone stopped ordering off the suppliers. A number of suppliers went bust. Mm-hmm. And then they realized actually the market wasn't going down. It was growing. So they put massive orders and those suppliers couldn't deliver to anyone. Yeah. So it's this whole thing.
So supply chain issues over. Is that coming to an end now? Or?
Yes, I think that's come to the end now. There will always be. When a good supplier goes bust or disappears, there is a hole that's left.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been a bit of a challenge.
And then I should have maybe asked at the start, but I'm sure you've told many people, where does the name come from?
Well, yeah, so The name is an interesting one. We were a sort of British company with a very sounding French name, Bremont. My surname's English. We couldn't use the name English, obviously. And I didn't want to go by an old British brand. So I could have gone and brought Harrison, the watch clock brand, the inventor of the marine chronometer, an amazing genius. But I felt if I'd done that, I'd have constantly been pretending I was a very old brand, marine chronometer producer. Yeah. How could I go and work with Williams Racing or America's Cup or with the military? It just didn't feel truthful. Whereas if you see a lot of the Swiss brands, they haven't been trading forever. They're all relaunched after the Quartz Revolution. Yep. Many of them died. So the first 3 years, we were building watches with no name on in all our prototype stage. And Nick and I were on a flying trip going through France in an old biplane. And these are days before GPS. And we got horrendously lost. And we knew we were close to the airfield, but it was a grass airstrip. We couldn't find it. And we're flying around in pea soup conditions. Mm-hmm. And
a
running.
Bit like today, actually.
A bit like today. Yeah. I mean, it's. And we had to force land in a French farmer's pea field. And if you do that in England or America, it's you give the farmer a bottle of whiskey, say sorry, take his wife for a fly when the weather's better. But in France, because it's a non-licensed airfield, they make you take the wings off, ship your plane to an airfield. It costs a fortune. It's a nightmare. And this lovely old boy said, look, come and put your plane in my hay barn. Wait till the weather's better. Stay with me. And then go on your way and stay with him for a couple of days. The weather was terrible for a couple of days. And he was this lovely old boy in his late 70s. And he had these tractors he was restoring, loved his old motorbikes, his carriage clocks.
It's almost like you're at home.
Well, it was. And my dad died when he was 48. And we saw this guy. Said if our dad had lived to his late 70s, he would have been just like this old boy. And his name was Antoine Bremont. And we went off and we thought, Bremont, that's a nice sounding name. And we called him up and said, look, we're not associating this with you in any way, shape, or form, but we like the name. We might call us our brand Bremont. And he went, ah, crazy Englishman. And that's where the name came from and stuck with us ever since.
Amazing. What a lovely story. What do you think you would have done differently?
In hindsight, I think you have done hundreds of things differently. But at the time, they all seemed like the right decision, and so I think there are just too many individual business errors. I think the key things, I think probably the growth is not always number one. I think you can slow growth down and just take your time over it, and I think you can make better decisions often by saying, no, we're not going to grow this year, but we're going to actually make it go to the bottom line, and there's no rush here. And I think often you grow for growth's sake and not actually be benefited from that.
But it's hard if you've got investors or shareholders.
You've got investors and shareholders. But I think that point goes to investors and shareholders. Yeah. Sometimes if growth isn't there, it's not a bad thing. It's just taking your time and getting it right. It's very easy in our game to make bad calls with distributors and the wrong partners around the world, where short term, it's brilliant. It gives you that growth, but long term, it's not the right decision to make.
So how many distributors do you have currently?
Well, not many. We sort of had a couple of bad issues in the early times. So We don't.
And you'd rather go direct.
We'd rather go direct. And that's been. We will, and we're launching in the Middle East and with a new partner out there, which will be a. And I think we've done it the right way working with those partners. I think the other thing is just, don't try and follow the crowd. If everyone follows the crowd, you're doing things late to the party and the efficiencies won't be there, whether it's...
Yeah, you're definitely behind the curve.
You're behind the curve. And I think it's very easy to be sucked into that. this is the fashion, everything's going mm-hmm. that way. But actually be your own person, be your own business, and realize in life, not everyone's going to like you. And that's not the rule. You don't want everyone to like yeah. you. You want some people to love you and some people to not like you. And that's who you are. It means that you're not bland.
Yes.
And it's
yes.
very easy. I see in brands and businesses, everyone, they're trying to appease everyone. They become yeah. very vanilla in their approach.
But you have great, you've created, both you and Nick, you've created an incredible brand, which has brand aspiration and customer aspiration, I should say. I think through your advertising, through your ambassador network, and through also, I think that the military, that history part does give a lot of credence and quality to the brand as well.
Yeah, and I think it's just authentic. And yeah, Nick and
that's
I,
maybe the word I'm looking
yeah,
for.
Yeah, I think Nick and I don't ever want to work with anyone we don't like, and they go for ambassadors as well.
Yeah.
And we want to work with something that Nick and I have generally felt passionate about. And without that, it's very hard to sell.
Yeah.
You can't sell your vision and your yeah. love if you don't yeah. have that. And now things are changing. So, and we're discussing we have a new investor on board.
Yes, you do. I was going to bring that up.
But yeah.
I mean, maybe you can mention your new investor.
So we had a customer by a chap called Bill Ackman, who had been a customer of ours for a number of years, and he wrote to us and said, look, I love my watches. I think you're a hidden gem as a business, and I think we can grow the business a lot more. Would you let me invest? And so he came on board about 12 months ago, and as part of that deal, they wanted a new management team, a new CEO mm-hmm. to come and join the business. So we've been going through that process at the moment.
How are you finding that?
Well, I think as a founder, it's difficult.
Of course.
But you sign up for it,
yeah.
so you can't complain. But it is difficult, and you're going through that transition. But I think it's probably advice to anyone out there is just make sure everything is very clear.
Yes.
And you things never go quite mm-hmm. as to plan as you think they're going to go. But you sign the document, you take the money, you got to roll with it.
I mean, it's an incredible accolade, really, to have someone like Bill to be involved, I think.
I think, look, it's lovely, and we've got this other brilliant investor in Select Equity who joined us a number of years ago, and these are individuals who have a long-term view over what you're trying to do,
mm-hmm.
And we're an amazing business in that sense because we're building this luxury brand. We're not in a technological arms race, so if we don't
yes.
make it in the next 2 years,
yeah, you're not going to miss out.
You're not going to miss out. And yes, you don't get everything right, and there'll be changes as you go along. But actually, you know, we will be here in 50 years' time, and we'll be bigger and stronger. And I think the love for mechanical watches, I don't believe will ever go away. Mm-hmm. And the reason I
actually maybe she grows as people are used to having their computers on their wrists now.
Yeah.
That actually there is a revert back to mechanical watches.
You want to get away from that. Yeah. And
we don't need to read our emails on our wrists.
You really don't.
Our wrists.
And I love luxury pens as well. And everyone says, who writes anymore? But
we're discussing this on another podcast the other day, actually, a chap who'd come to school in England from India and discussing how everyone still loves to get letters.
Yeah. And to write with something beautiful. And yeah. I think it's, I always say there's 86,400 seconds in a day. A mechanical yeah. watch leaves here, it's within 3 or 4 seconds accurate. That is, the most mechanical accurate device on the planet. And that mechanical watch will be working in 200 years' time.
Yeah.
Yes, you have to service it. If it breaks, you can fix it. But what do we buy these days that lasts forever? And I think for the amount that people pay, I think you've got something very special. And I think for those who have never had a lovely watch, it's something you really connect mm-hmm. with, and you'll pass your kids. And our military guys who buy our watches, these are family heirlooms
yeah.
to them. If you're flying an F-18 for 7 years of your life. The rest of your life, you talk about your F-18 flying, yeah. and that's proof, and you give it to your son, your grandson. And I think that it's a lovely thing, but they're not easy to make, but they are here forever, and I think that's it's lovely to be part of that.
So how do you see the future for Bremworth and also for you, Giles?
Well, it's interesting. So I think future of Bremworth, I think we've got the right investors on board. I think I hope the management make the right decisions and with our baby and taking it forward from that. And I think that will be, you know, and obviously we're on the board, so we're closely aligned. For Nick and myself, I think we have a genuine love of businesses, brand, engineering. So we are generally looking out and talking to other people about other things to get involved with. And I think always happy to help. And I think we have a new, unique perspective on
for sure.
on growing this. But that's a genuine enthusiasm for what we do.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Now, Giles, as my regular listeners know, I like to end on three questions. So I'm going to take one at a time. I may have guessed your first one, but we'll carry on. Your greatest inspiration or mentor?
Well, I think you guess is with our father. And I think partly just his enthusiasm for life. I think really growing up, there were no boundaries of what you can go and achieve in his way. He wanted to enjoy life as much as achieve. And I think that's very easy with many high achievers is to not sit back and enjoy life. And life isn't all about making money. It's about family, friends, enjoyment, interests outside work as well. And he certainly had all of those. But yeah, he was definitely been my inspiration and I think Nick's as well.
And then a book which has inspired you?
Yeah, I was thinking about the books. There was one by Sir Francis Chichester. And Sir Francis Chichester, for me, was always an inspirational character. He started out as a pilot. Everyone knows him for sailing around the world.
Exactly.
But he was one of the first men to fly solo to Australia, there and back. And as a pilot, introduced whole new methods of navigating. And he flew a Gypsy Moth, and hence he named his boat Gypsy Moth. Yeah. And I owned a Gypsy Moth as well, which very sadly had a very bad plane crash in and broke my back. But that's another story. I think his inspiration through all of his books of getting in a plane and just going and flying to Australia, he then crashed, I think it was in Japan, gave up flying and got into sailing, trained a lot of the World War II pilots navigation techniques. And I think there's one story where he landed, his flying, I think, to across to Australia, across the sea there, and landed. He had floats in his aircraft. Mm-hmm. Checked his engine out, you know, in the middle of the sea, had a smoke of his pipe. You know, flick started the plane and got back in
carried on going.
And learning to navigate by looking at the wind and the waves, flying low, using his sextant while flying.
Oh, my God.
And if you've flown a Gypsy Moth, it's all over the place.
But also, if you've sailed with a sextant, you know it's also very difficult.
It's unbelievable. So I think the talents and I recommend, I couldn't pick one of his books, but any of his books, he was, him and Amy Johnson, when she first flew to Australia, is another unbelievable story. And these early pioneers, these adventurers, and I think it's quite a British thing, this adventure thing, and it's always been a big part of the Bremworth DNA. I love these individuals who, you know, Amy Johnson had 30 hours of flying, got on a plane and strapped a spare propeller on her wing and flew to Australia. I mean, where does that come from? And I think these explorers we've been lucky enough around, whether it's from Nims to Kenton Cool to Ben Saunders, who have achieved these great things, it's inspirational to be around and read about.
And then finally, what piece of advice would you give to a young person starting out on their career?
I think not everyone is an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
and often developing your career in a bigger business may be better for you. To be an entrepreneur, you have to really cope with stress. You have to thrive off it and thrive off almost mess in front of you, and you're creating some clarity amongst that. And I think you read a lot about the youth who want to go, I want to go and start my own thing.
Yeah.
You really, really have to want it to start your own thing. And actually, you'll probably make more money and have a lot of fun working for a bigger business. But if you really do, and you're happy to work 24/7 for no money and all that risk, then it's a wonderful thing and process to go and start your own project.
Fantastic. And then how can listeners get in touch with you?
Probably best social media, at Giles English. And you can go onto the website and book a tour to come around Bramall.
Yes, when we were in reception today, you had a number of people coming in for a tour.
So if you're interested in watches, you're in Henley-on-Thames, definitely come and visit. And we have various events in our stores in London. But we'd love to hear from you and see you. Any questions, I'm always happy to help and inspire if possible.
Giles, this has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for your wonderful hospitality today. It's been great to see you.
Nick, really appreciate you having me on your podcast, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to A Different Perspective, a Zeus podcast. If you'd like to feature on the podcast or get in touch, you can contact me on live@zeuscapital.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.